I'm Megan.
I'm Christy.
And we are
Homebrew Murder Crew.
Why are we so bad at this?
Well, because every time we get into it, like, I don't know if I get pixelated and go frozen, but you do for me.
Oh, I'm so silly.
It's probably my computer. My computer is a piece of shit. I need to update my RAM, but obviously, remote again. Megan, did you go get some wine tonight?
No, I'm having a beer.
Oh, well, you know what? Beer is fine. So cheers. I do have some wine. I figured.
Cheers.
I was like, I'm gonna make some tea. Cheers. And then I was like, no, I'm going to get some wine.
I like really planned on having wine, but then Martin and I went to go get the girls. And then he was like, oh, I forgot my wallet. I'm like, that's okay because I have mine. And then we got to the store and I was like, I have my wallet, but my debit card's not in it.
Oh, shite.
So we just came home.
Yeah. I am going to put my watch on. Fun times. So what are you bringing here, Megs?
I'm taking this back to the evening of February 10th, 1982.
Ooh.
When a call came in on the emergency line in the small town of Okotoks, Alberta, Canada.
I live there.
I know. And before you say anything about me calling it a small town, because right now there's an estimated population of 37,550. Mm-hmm. But in 1982, it was recorded of a population of only 4,521.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that crazy? Fun facts.
That's
about
insane.
Okotoks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Added that for you.
Thank you.
Every time I call Okotoks a small town, you're like, we've got like 40,000 people.
I know, right? I thought I was moving to a small town and then we moved here and I was like, oh,
not so small town.
You know what? You know what though? I'll take it over Calgary any day.
Same, but alas, here I am in Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
So the emergency call came in. A woman had called to report that her husband had taken a bunch of pills and was attempting to kill himself. Despite Okotoks being a small town at the time, the call had come from the even smaller town of Blackie, Alberta. It was so small that it wasn't even considered a town in 1982. It was a village.
Oh, wow.
The paramedics from Okotoks drove out to Blackie, Alberta, and to the home of Robert Brown and his wife. When they arrived, they found a 33-year-old man in distress. Despite the fact that he was dying, he refused treatment and refused to get in the ambulance. The paramedics, noting he was in dire need of a trip to the hospital, contacted the Okotoks RCMP dispatch for assistance. One of the officers who was dispatched to the home for Robert Brown was Constable Robert Laird, who would recount the events of the evening in 1982 for an article written by community reporter and Canadian media personality Lorraine Hajalt. Constable Robert Laird would tell the reporter that when he arrived at the home, he had convinced Robert to get into the back seat of his police cruiser, and that he would personally drive him to the hospital in High River, Alberta.
Sorry, I'm confused about you said the article, because I thought this was I forget the year that this happened.
Yeah, so but then you 1982.
Said, okay, and then you said the article was from 2018.
So I really screwed this one up, didn't I? The officer was Constable Robert Laird, and I found this information from an article that came out in 2016.
Oh, I see.
But he told the reporter, like he recounted the events of that night, and he told the reporter that on the night of 1982, February 10th, he had convinced Robert Brown to get into the back seat of his police cruiser, and that they and he would drive him personally to the hospital in High River.
Okay.
Paramedic had to ride along with them, as Robert Brown was in his care as he was, you know, essentially dying. Mm-hmm. And the paramedic chose to sit in the front seat next to the constable.
Okay.
Robert Brown was actually known to Constable Laird. He did not go into details how he knew him exactly, but I suspect his knowledge of Robert Brown is what led him to ask the question, quote, "Robert, did you have anything to do with the murder of those two girls?" Unquote. Constable Lair told the reporter for Okotoks Online, quote, "apparently a pig farm at one point." He's not the pig farmer named Robert you might be familiar with.
Right, yeah.
But he did work at a pig farm and his name is Robert. Anyways, he presumably worked odd jobs because of his criminal records. Robert Edward Brown was born in Athelstan, now called Hitchinbrook, Quebec, in 1949. By the age of 9, he had already lived in 3 different foster homes. His mother was deemed unfit, and there is no history of his father that I was able to find. By the age of 12, in 1961, Robert Brown was committed to Shawbridge Boys Farm and Training School, a youth detention center in Montreal that still exists today. It is actually named in what is Canada's largest class action lawsuit, which is against the government of Quebec for abuse that took place in the center, along with other centers across Quebec that they knew about and did not intervene. He was...
Holy shit.
We will look a little bit more into that.
Yeah, of course.
So at the ripe age of 12, he was caught breaking and entering into a property and arrested. That same year, his biological mother was committed to an institution for unknown mental illness. Between 1961 and 1971, Robert Brown served time for assault and robberies with violence in several prisons throughout Quebec. At the age of 17 in 1966, he was sentenced in Campbell Bay, Quebec, that's 1 hour northwest of Ottawa, for indecent assault, so sexual assault that did not involve rape, breaking and entering, and theft. In July of 1981, while driving down an isolated road, Robert Brown attempted to run over a hitchhiker. The hitchhiker was 28-year-old James Edward Peters. He ended up not running the guy over, and instead the two became best buds and literal partners in crime. That's what I mean. A chance encounter with another deranged individual.
Oh, what the hell?
Yeah, so they became best buddies and like
holy shit.
Literal partners in crime when Robert Brown suggested to James Peters that they find a woman, rape her, and James readily agreed. After they scouted several prospects, they found their one on the early morning of December 12th, 1981. The 23-year-old Debbie Stevens was leaving a work Christmas party for the company that she worked for. She was a training supervisor with an oil well service company. The party was in the big city of Calgary. That's about 80 kilometers, about 49.71 miles north of where Debbie lived in High River. A co-worker of Debbie's would later tell a reporter with the Lethbridge Herald that himself, as well as many fellow colleagues at the party, had tried to convince Debbie to either stay or take a taxi home, as they had all refused to drive her due to being intoxicated. Mm-hmm. Debbie chose to leave against their suggestions and drive herself. Driving along the rural roads between Calgary and High River, her car ran out of gas. About 56 kilometers. So it was like 11 kilometers from High River. She had 11 kilometers left to go when her car ran out of gas. So the 23-year-old was forced to hitchhike the remainder of the way home.
Oh, geez.
So
it's just for like for anybody who's like me, who's like kilometers and miles don't mean anything. It's like from Calgary to High River, it's about 40 minutes. It's about a 40-minute drive.
Yeah. Thank you. So they had about 11 kilometers left. Like, so it's probably about 12 minutes from home.
Yeah.
Driving. 12-minute drive. Yeah. So on December 12th, 1981, it was estimated of about minus 15 degrees Celsius. When a car with two men inside offered her a ride, she wasn't really in a position to refuse. Only she was not driven home. Instead, the two men were Robert Brown and James Peters, and they drove her to an isolated area in the countryside where they took turns sexually assaulting her.
Oh, Jesus.
Then they put her back in their car and drove her even further out, further away from civilization, where Robert Brown struck Debbie in the back of the head with a tire iron, and the two men proceeded to take turns beating her until she took her final breath.
Oh, my God.
Robert and James then left Debbie's body on the side of a riverbank and drove away.
Oh.
So when Debbie had not returned home that night, the next morning, she was immediately reported missing. It was known far and wide of the missing 23-year-old from High River. It was big news. That kind of stuff didn't happen often, so everybody was talking about it.
Yeah.
And that's the reason I suspect that Robert and James returned to the creekside they had left Debbie's body at only 2 days later on the 14th and set her remains on fire.
Oh, fuck.
So on December 15th, the following day, Debbie Stevens' body was discovered on the river's edge, burned. The river was burned. Burned, the same river valley they had left her at. It was just 11 kilometers from her home.
Oh my God.
I'm assuming so that the close. Fire alerted somebody to the location.
Yeah.
The murder of Debbie Stevens shocked the town of High River, as well as all the surrounding towns, Okotoks, Calgary, etc. Blackie, even. Things like this did not happen often in the smaller communities surrounding the big city of Calgary.
No. And even still, like, I mean, like, we talk about it all the time when we're, like, updating on true crime news and stuff. And a lot of what we see and what we report is a lot of stuff that we see going on in the big city.
Yeah.
But, like, this type of crime, you don't really see in Okotoks or High River right now, despite the fact that both of these towns have grown substantially since that time, since 1982. Yeah. Or whatever. And yeah, and you just, it's, wow, like, I had no idea about this.
I know. I haven't even gotten to, like, Okotoks really yet, but.
Right.
The murder of Debbie would remain unsolved for the next month. It was unknown of what Robert Brown and James Peter were up to, but it's presumed that they'd stay out of trouble.
Right.
Until they couldn't stay out of trouble for long, because January 30th, 1982, so the murder of Debbie happened December 12th, 1981. So just over a month later, almost 2 months later, January 30th, 1982, James Peters and Robert Brown were at it again. This time they were driving around the city of Calgary looking for another lone woman to attack. They're basically like scouting for victims. Like, so yeah, disgusting. And apparently they used to go on these cruises often, where they just cruise around Calgary, Okotoks, High River, all those areas looking for, like, women on their own.
Yeah. And how many people still do that, like, to this day?
Yeah.
The only difference is that we have, like, cell phones that we can call people kind of immediately, yeah, or that are tracking us, or, like, our friends know our location and that sort of thing. Like, that's the biggest difference, right?
Yeah, exactly. While they were cruising, they came across an 18-year-old named Linda, last name unknown, who would tell the Calgary Herald about how Robert Brown and James Peters, on the evening of January 30th, 1982, had tried to trick her. At the time, she was a 5-foot petite teenager. They tried to trick her into leaving her glassed-in booth at the gas station that she worked at in Southeast Calgary neighborhood of Mindapore. Yeah.
That's so close to home.
I know. Robert Brown had approached the window and asked Linda to help him as his friend's car had broken down just down the street. He tried to get her to come out of the car, the glass booth to help him, but she refused to leave. Robert then purchased some gas from her, filled up a jerry can, and walked away. Linda would tell the reporter, quote, "Peters and Brown attempted to get me to exit the booth to help them, as they told me they were having issues with their car. I refused, telling them that I was not allowed to leave my booth without another employee to accompany me. I had no idea that decision I had made at that moment would save my life."
No kidding.
"I can tell you how many times, I can't tell you how many times over the past 36 years I have given thanks for my intuition that night."
Yeah.
Like, absolutely, right? And like,
girl.
Yes.
Holy.
Like, I couldn't even imagine. That's scary. Ugh.
That's so scary. And like, working that late and you're by yourself and, oh my God, and you're 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Ugh. Shady, shady shit, man.
Absolutely. I also found in a Reddit article, like or somebody's Reddit post, that on that night that they'd failed to get Linda to leave her booth, they also were going to attempt to abduct a young woman that was standing at a bus stop in downtown Calgary. But before they could approach the woman, a bus came and scared them off.
Fuck.
This drove just them out of the
prowlers, hey?
Yeah. This drove the two men out of the big city. And they would take their hunt for a victim to the smaller town of Okotoks, where at 10:30 p.m. on that night, on January 30th, 1982, they found a lone woman working at a Red Rooster convenience store. I looked into it. The convenience store is no longer open.
What is in its place, you know?
I tried to find it. I couldn't find anything about it.
You should send me like a pin drop of where it was.
I couldn't even find the address.
Really?
We can try to figure out what it is, and then we can give an update on
the next
episode.
We'll try to figure it out, yeah.
Not even kidding. Yeah. I was like, oh, I bet Christy would love to know what's there now.
Even update, but just like for me, like I want to know where that was, right?
Oh, absolutely. I know. And I looked because I was like, I'm sure Christy's going to want to know what's there now because that's where you live, essentially.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It's actually in here. It's since closed. Not sure what's there now. Tried to find it. Yeah.
Surely it can be found.
Yeah.
Surely it has to be able to be found.
Surely. The lone worker was a 16-year-old girl named Lori Boyd.
What? Oh, this again with the times. 16-year-old
working alone.
Be working by themselves.
At a convenience store.
Yeah.
Robert and James went into the store and they held a screwdriver to her neck and escorted her out of the store and into their car. They drove Lori out of town, where both men later confessed to taking turns raping her, before they stabbed her more than 15 times. And then in their attempt to conceal the evidence, they chose to douse her body in the gasoline they had purchased earlier from Linda in Calgary and set her body on fire. So,
what was her name again? Sorry?
Lori Boyd.
Lori Boyd.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So,
16 years old.
Yeah. Lori had actually been half an hour out of finishing her shift. Her shift was over at 11, and this was about 10:30. When she was abducted by these two sickos.
Oh my God.
Obviously, when she didn't come home from work, her parents reported her missing.
Yeah.
Lori's body was actually found by a farmer on a gravel road just 36 kilometers east of Okotoks the next day. The whole area was on edge. Two young women were picked up and murdered in the span of just 48 days, doused in gasoline and set ablaze. Police had few leads. Constable Laird would tell reporters that, quote, people were then calling in all kinds of suspicious activity. They were reporting strange activities by their neighbors or people they knew because everybody was trying to figure out who was responsible for these terrible crimes.
Yeah, because now you can't trust anybody.
Exactly.
So anything that seems out of the ordinary, and you're being hyper-vigilant, so anything that seems out of the ordinary, out of somebody's, like, regular, you know, what's that called? Routine.
Yeah.
You're hyper-fixated on, and that's going to send up red flags for you.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, people want to be a hero.
Yeah. So a large amount of those tips that were coming in were just people that, I don't know, had beefs with their neighbors and stuff. But one tip that came in pointed them to Robert Brown, a key suspect who became a key suspect when a woman who had hitched a ride with Robert and Peter in the days between Debbie and Lori's murders reported their erratic behavior to police.
Okay.
So they were already on, I suspect that's why Constable Laird had asked Robert in the back of that cruiser about the two girls. They were already being looked into on February 10th, 1982, when Robert's wife called the emergency line to report her husband's attempted suicide. So now
when you started this story, Megs, I was like, ooh, this is like a Black Widow type story, you know, like wife
poisons
husband. And then you totally twisted that shit up like so early. And I love it. Like, I hate this story, but I'm fucking here for learning about it, man.
I know. So the morning after Robert Brown was released from the hospital and was questioned, he was arrested and transferred to the police when he was arrested. During police questioning, Robert Brown had indicated that he had committed other murders in Alberta and seven across Canada in total. He had also implemented James Peters pretty quickly.
They're fucking serial killers.
Yeah, wow. James was just arrested 7 days later on February 17th, 1982. James Edward Peters was arrested while he was applying for a job as a chicken farmer in Okotoks. Random facts, but I like these little details that they add in to the articles I got all this information from. James Peters was first to confess. He expressed fear of retaliation from Robert. But once police assured him
he was fear safe. Of being run over finally like you were supposed to have been.
So once they assured him that he was safe, he folded. Folded like a fitted sheet. No, I'm just kidding. He folded like a regular sheet because folded sheets are fucking difficult.
Right.
James Peters told investigators that Robert was the mastermind. The sole purpose of their actions was for the sexual assault. He even said that it was an opportunity to have sex with these women he otherwise would not have a chance with. Disgusting. Disgusting. Oh,
18 and 16 years old, sir.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how old was he at the time?
28.
Ugh, gross, dude. It was an opportunity I wouldn't have otherwise. That's...
Debbie Stevens was actually 23. Get run over. Debbie was actually 23, but I don't think age really mattered to them.
There was one 18-year-old who...
The girl at the gas station.
That was at the gas station.
Yeah.
And then the 16-year-old at the Red Robin, whatever it was, that they
Lori
got.
Lori Boyd. Yeah.
Right, Lori Boyd. But then, yeah, I get it. But,
Guys. So, I know.
Spit on your hand and call it a day.
Yeah. James Peter also said that after the sexual assault, Robert lost control and murdered both women, implying Robert was insane. He was not. He was deemed sane, by the way. Evidence showed they both took part in the beating of Debbie and the stabbing of Lori.
Yeah.
Both Robert and James were diagnosed with antisocial disorders. And during their trial, prosecutors asked a psychologist how two men diagnosed with antisocial disorders could agree to this plan of, to agree to a plan of this magnitude. The psychologist replied with, quote, God makes them and they find each other, unquote.
Fuck God.
Yeah.
Leave God out of this.
Yeah.
The dude Robert tried to run him the fuck over.
Right.
And then what, changed his mind last minute and was like, yo, man, I want to be friends. And Buddy's like, you know what? Yeah, I could use a friend right now. Like he didn't just try to run him the fuck over. Like, I don't understand. This is so wild.
That's a part of the case that I'm like, that's insane. That's insane. A year later, on January 6, 1983, both James Edward Peters and Robert Edward Brown were found guilty and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for 25 years. Yep, that means both men will be eligible for parole in 2008. Good old Canada.
Oh.
Good old Canada laws.
Protecting the convicted.
Yeah.
Better than your protecting the citizens.
Yeah.
Innocent citizens.
Yeah. Despite RCMP Sergeant Ray Forsyth saying in a news conference that Robert Brown indicated his involvement in seven other murders across Canada between 1964 and 1981. He said, quote, he has given us details of the various crimes and they are being checked. I believe him in some of the cases, unquote.
Okay.
So, if any of you are familiar with the case of Teresa Allure, she was 19 years old when she went missing on November 3rd, 1978 from her dormitory residence in Compton, Quebec. Her remains were later found 5 months later in a body of water 1 kilometer from her dormitory residence. Police really messed up that case, which led to her brother, John Allure, devoting his life to solving her murder.
His investigation sounds so familiar. So familiar.
I read the book. His investigation spanned from 1978 to his untimely death in 2023, RIP John. And he wrote a book titled Wish You Were Here.
Because you told me about this book. That's why, yeah. I think.
So I will probably cover that case in more detail at a later date, but it's a great read and I highly recommend it. But he investigated many other unsolved murders in an attempt to find links to his sisters. And he actually uncovered evidence of a possible serial killer in the 70s in Montreal that he dubbed the Bootlace Killer.
Wow.
A raft of these murders had taken place in 1977, and that was the year that, towards the end, Robert Brown left for Alberta.
Okay.
But we may never know if he was involved in these murders in Quebec, because he lived there at the time. And the MO kind of matched a little bit with what happened to Debbie and Lori. But it's a theory that he may have been involved in these crimes.
Right.
Police in Quebec, surprisingly, claimed to have had no knowledge of Robert Brown, despite the fact that he had a lengthy criminal history there and spent a lot of time in their prison. Police in Ontario...
How the fuck does that work?
I don't know. Because they really dropped the ball on a lot of these. Like, in that time frame, the 1970s, 1980s, there were so many unsolved murders that they just poorly investigated. Like Teresa's. Yeah. Teresa, they came forward and said that she'd run away originally and weren't even looking for her. And then 5 months later, she was found dead. And they were like, oh, whoopsies. Oh, like, and that's what led, like, her brother literally spent his entire entire life focused on trying to solve his sister's murder.
That's why these like independent projects and stuff, like when you see them come up, like for example, I know like Crime Junkie does a whole bunch of work with like the Doe Project or whatever.
Yeah.
Or, and I think maybe the Innocence Project.
Yeah.
Like same deal. There's a lot of people, just as many people as there are that aren't, that their crimes aren't looked into well enough by police, like by government issued police services or whatever. The same amount of people are being convicted for crimes that they haven't done based on poor evidence and swaying a jury the wrong way or whatever. So it's just as important to look into that as it is like the victims of you know, but
no.
That's what's so important to give to these places. And like and I'll get into it with our Patreon and everything too at the end of the episode, but that's where you see a lot of podcasts take that money and that monetary, you know, value that they obtain from their podcasts and give back to their communities.
Yeah.
But you can't trust the fucking police.
No, you
can't trust the fucking judicial system. Whether you're in Canada or the United States, wherever, I don't care. It's so hard sometimes. Unless you're of a privileged background or you're a privileged person, it's so hard to get justice in the way that you need it.
I agree. If I remember correctly from reading that book, it's been a while. He also uncovered a possible serial killer here in Calgary in the 70s as well. But they were targeting sex trade workers downtown Calgary.
I think, I know it's one you're talking about,
That would also match up with the timeline that Robert Brown was here.
Right.
But police in Ontario and in Nova Scotia also claim to have suspected Robert Brown of murders in their provinces, but nothing has come of these suspicions. So,
and is Robert Brown still alive?
Well, here, so funny that you ask me that, because I was actually just about to tell you two things. First thing, the reason I came across this case is my mom told me about it at my birthday dinner. Yeah. She's like, oh, did you ever hear of this case? And I'm like, no. So apparently my opa was actually carjacked knife point by Robert Brown in the late 1970s.
Shot the front fucking door. How does he know it was Robert Brown?
Because when he got arrested and they saw his photo, my opa was like, that's the guy.
Oh my God.
Right? And I was like, excuse me, Mama G, how have you never told me this before? So anyways, so by some kind of morbid justice, in 1986, only 3 years after he was sentenced and put in prison, Robert Brown, during a fight in prison, was stabbed by a fellow inmate and died from his injuries.
Oh, shit. I'm just looking up Robert Brown right now. I wonder if I can find Robert Edward Brown.
So despite all of the information I was able to give you about Robert Edward Brown, I couldn't find much on James Edward Peters. Uh-huh. He had no prior...
How are they both Edwards? How are they both middle name Edwards?
I don't know, right? Right? I thought about that too. So James Edward Peters, who was younger, a little bit younger, he had no prior convictions. But in 20... I found in an article for the Calgary Herald that... James Peters was actually accused of raping at knife point a young daughter of a previous employer of his. He was never charged or convicted of this crime. The accusation definitely rings true with the similarities in that and the murders of Debbie and Lori, of course.
What happened with him? Did he get convicted?
Well, they both got sentenced to life in prison for 25 years. Life in prison without the possibility of parole for 25 years. But here's the real shit. End of the stick. The real shitty part. Who knows how many other victims this fucking psycho had. But he didn't have to wait the 25 years to apply for parole.
Of course not.
So relying on a provision of the criminal code called the Faint Hope Clause, a law written and passed by Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau's federal Liberal government the sentence of life with no eligibility of parole for 25 years was rendered a lie. James applied for parole after just serving 15 years because of the faint hope clause. This is when Lori Boyd's mama bear, Darlene yes. Boyd, started her fight against that law.
Wow. So yes.
immediately upon James Peters' first application for early release, she traveled to Ottawa to lobby then federal justice minister Alan Rock, whom she described as a man lacking compassion. She would say, quote, it was like talking to a brick wall, unquote.
Oh my God.
But after years of lobbying, particularly through the media, Rock made a slight change to section 745 of the criminal code to make it impossible for people like Peters, who are convicted of murdering more than one person, to apply for their lower parole eligibility from 25 to any time after 15 years. Stupid.
Okay,
you still passed. You'll be happy to know that once federal conservatives had a majority government, Bill S-6 was passed, which struck the faint hope clause from the law books. So after December 2nd, 2011, convicted first-degree murderers are no longer eligible to apply for parole before eligibility date decided upon Good. When they were sentenced.
I don't understand how it was ever a thing, how it was ever, anybody ever thought that this was a good idea, though.
Yeah.
It's just, like, it blows my fucking mind. So this guy, then, is he still alive?
We'll get there. Darlene Boyd was a true fighter. Doug and Darlene Boyd went to every parole hearing for James Peter over the years. The last one I was able to find any information about was actually in 2018. This is actually the same year that Okotoks opened the new pedestrian bridge over Sheep River that they have named the Lori Boyd Bridge.
Oh.
The older bridge that this new one replaced was actually dedicated to Lori in 1995.
Okay, which bridge is this? Is this the bridge over Southridge Drive or is it the bridge over 32nd Street?
I'm not sure. I'll have to look that up. During that hearing in 2018, there was another injustice and an upset. And this granted James Edward Peter certain privacies. He was denied parole at that time, but the Parole Board of Canada cannot share certain written decisions with the media or even with the victims' families. In a 2018 Calgary Herald article, it was, and they put it best, saying, quote, putting a double murderer's privacy rights ahead of public safety and putting a double murderer's privacy rights ahead of public safety and the right to know, unquote. Apparently, at the time that he was applying for parole, he was also applying for ETAs, which is escorted temporary absences from prison. And this is the decision that cannot be shared, which means there's a good possibility this fucking asshat was granted these ETAs and can leave prison whenever he wants to go out and be amongst the public. And
nobody can know about it because it can't be shared.
Even the families of Debbie and Lori.
Yeah, so because you know why? I understand why is because they're afraid of vigilante justice. But like, for fuck's sakes, why does he get more rights and more protection than the woman who is fucking that he murdered?
Exactly. But unfortunately, this is the last I was able to find about James Edward Peter. There is no new hearings as of today. Nothing in the news about him since 2018. Nobody, I don't know where he is. I don't know what he's doing. I don't even know if the guy's still alive. And sadly, Lori's mother, Darlene Boyd, passed away on January 3rd, 2023 in a hospital in Vulcan, Alberta. She was 75 years old.
Oh, rest in peace. I'm so sorry. She's with her daughter now.
Yeah. Well, that
Wow.
is the fucked up case of Debbie Stevens and Lori Boyd.
Oh my God, Megan, that was a roller coaster. I don't think that we've had a case that was that like all over the place
I know.
and like so many twists and turns and like holy.
But I mean, this might not be the end of this one if somehow they find
Right.
more evidence or find out and actually connect
Well, they
Rob.
have their DNA, so like
Yeah.
if more stuff comes up and all that stuff, but like, man, I know it hits a little bit harder because of how close to home it hits and how close to
Yeah.
home it is, right?
Yeah.
Whether or not I lived in Okotoks at the time, like I wasn't even born at the time, right?
No,
None of
no.
us were,
My
but
mom was.
well, like your mom was, but like none of us on the podcast were.
Yeah.
Yes, some of our listeners probably were and everything, but like, oh, it brings up so much hurt and frustration. Like you brought up so much about like just the way things are handled, the judicial system, like oh, and like companies allowing children, fucking children, to work overnight by themselves. It's
Right.
insane. And like I'm so happy to see that there's progress from that. Like that's not allowed anymore, and there are laws to protect children from that.
Yeah.
But my God, that was a good one, Megan. Thank you.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I don't want to say this is a good one, but you know
No,
what I mean.
I totally get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was one that I'd never really heard of either, despite like being this close to it.
Yeah.
We'll have to find the bridge though.
Yeah,
Pay
I gotta
our
figure that one
respects.
out. I'll figure that one out. Well, thank you to Mama G for suggesting that one to you.
Yes, thanks,
And
Mama G.
while we're on the topic of Mama G, I do want to shout out just as a reminder, we do have a Patreon now. And I know I mentioned it. Sorry, you guys, I am sick and my nose is blowing up right now. But I mentioned it a little bit ago of like podcasts that have Patreon and have a means for you to spend money to get certain access to like certain items, right? And so our Patreon, you have access, like early access to episodes, to full length episodes. You have exclusive access to microbrews, which are our shorter episodes. And we just did one last week that aired this week that we're recording. So it's out now, essentially. We did a microbrew on not so cryptid cryptids. So definitely go check that one out and subscribe. And it's only $3 a month, right, Megs? Like
Yes.
that's less than the cost of a cup of coffee a month.
Yeah.
And our proceeds primarily right now are going to go to us improving our podcast and the podcast experience for you guys, our listeners. So that means better equipment, better setup, etc. But once we're set up in that way, we obviously want to put some of that money, if not a majority of it, towards causes like what we talked about, the Innocence Project type deals, but like locally in Canada, and assisting families in getting justice and that sort of thing for their cases and what
Right.
they're, what they're finding, what they're seeking justice for. But on that note, I want to shout out Mama G.
My G.
Rita, you are our first and so far sole member of Patreon. You have access to all of our microbrews that we have pulled off of our regular listening platforms solely for the purpose of exclusiveness for our Patreon members. You will also have early access, Rita, and eventually we'll have a bloopers reel on there. And
Oh
not to
God.
mention, but because now we're recording on Riverside, it's all videotaped. So when the regular episode comes out, early access, you're going to get the video version of it. So you're going to see all our ridiculous mannerisms. You're going to find Auntie B picking her nose. She's not here, so I've got to pick on her for that. me sniffling and wiping my nose because I'm constantly freaking sick. But
Me not knowing
yeah,
what to
lots
do
of
with my hands.
Yeah, it's going to be lots of fun stuff. And we promise to only bring you more. So again, find us on Patreon. Please follow us. Donation, $3 a month. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Megs, do you have anything else to say?
Nothing else tonight, guys. Go and follow us on our socials and on Patreon.
And on Patreon. And we are on Facebook at Homebrew Murder Crew.
We're on Instagram at Homebrew Murder Crew.
And we're on the Tiki Taki at Homebrew Murder Crew. Wow. We're on TikTok at Homebrew Murder Crew. I like literally had an aneurysm just there. Definitely follow us on TikTok because we want to get to 1,000 followers so that we can go live for you. Absolutely. And finally,
you can email us. Email us pictures of your animals, any suggestions. You can correct our terrible pronunciation of words. No, I'm just kidding. Please don't.
You can send us love. You can also send us your personal stories, whether they're true crimey, whether they're haunted, whether they're cryptid, or whatever. We want to hear your personal stories because we want to do listener episodes.
Absolutely. So you can email those to homebrewmurdercrew@gmail.com.
That's right, Megan.
And, nailed it. Got it right this time on the first go. So thank you for tuning in to listen to my case tonight.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure. And
we'll see you guys next week with a little microbrew, I guess. Woo-hoo. In between.
Absolutely. I'll come up.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.